You're listening to a 3CR podcast created in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
Welcome to Radical Australian Community Radio 3CR, streaming live on 3cr.org.au. The program is a podcast. You can access the podcast by going to 3cr.org.au. Daryl, the producer, is here. Hello, Daryl.
Hello, Joe.
Yeah, and we've got a guest from interstate, all the way from Brisbane.
We sure do.
I'm not sure if it's Dr. Drew Hutton or Mr. Drew Hutton.
Well, we'll find out, I guess.
Okay, hello, Drew. Are you there?
It's just plain Drew, Joe.
Just plain Drew. You know, the bloke I had in last week was just plain Hank. Look, thank you for giving up an hour of your time this week in another hour last week. I mean, maybe a lot of Victorian listeners wouldn't be aware of Mr. Drew Hutton and all the things he's done in an extraordinary lifetime. Now, I've got to make a confession. I knew Drew about 45 years ago. I haven't spoken to him for 45 years, but he's done. I've rotted here at the studios of 3CR and he's changed the world. How are you, Drew?
I'm good, Joe. Really good.
Yeah. Look, we're going to do two sessions because, as I said, you've done extraordinary things in your life, and currently you're in the middle of a maelstrom regarding the Greens Party. But we'll talk about that later on. Now, what year were you born?
I was born 1947, Joe. As I tell people, in the first half of the 20th century.
So you want to? You're a real baby boomer.
I am. I tell them that when they want me to do something quite extraordinary on the internet or something, and I explain I was born in the first half of the 20th century, so don't expect too much of me.
Yeah, but Drew, haven't you learnt? What you do is you surround yourself with talented young people, and you get them to do the work. That's what I do. Like people like Daryl, you know.
Grandchildren.
You got grandchildren. Where were you born?
I was born in a little place called Chinchilla, which is a small town in western Queensland.
Mm-hmm.
My dad was a butcher. My mum was a school teacher. And my dad had just come back from the war, met my mum, and they produced me. So,
right. Any siblings?
I've got three brothers.
Three brothers. So four brothers in Chinchilla.
Yes.
You would have raised the roof.
Well, we were considerable... Yeah, a reasonable percentage of the population of the town, actually.
Right.
It's only a small place.
Yeah. So what was Chinchilla noted for in those days?
Mixed farming.
Right.
It's interesting that it's on the Western Darling Downs, if your listeners know where that is. So it's a farming community rather than, you know, big pastoral stations. That's a bit further west.
Right.
I actually come from a family of stockmen and drovers. I'm the first Hutton in five generations to be neither a stockman nor a drover.
Driver, right. So how long had your family been around that area?
Since 1926.
26. So what was your dad like?
Oh, he's a lovely man, actually. I was very lucky with the parents that I chose.
I like that, the ones you chose.
he was a real sort of blokey man.
Yeah.
I mean, he was, you know, a fella born in 1913, what would you expect? But he was a very gentle sort of fellow for a butcher, you know. He was very interested in sort of physical stuff, sports. He was a very good sportsman himself.
Right.
And he pushed me into sport, and I was very grateful to him for that.
He was
a good role model, my father, but was my mum was the sort of centre of my moral universe. She was an intellectual and a very moral person.
Right. Now, I'm going to ask you a question I've been meaning to ask the son of a butcher for many, many years, especially one from regional Queensland. Did they actually put sawdust in the sausages?
No. Well, I actually made sausages for my dad on many occasions, but I didn't see one ounce of sawdust.
Okay, all right. So just another thing they used to say about Queensland butchers, you know.
I know, they did, yeah.
Yeah, they put a bit of sawdust.
Along with putting a thumb on the weighing scales.
Oh, yeah, when you had weighing scales in those days.
Yep.
And how did you get on with your brothers?
Oh, good. We're still very close.
Right. What, they're all alive?
They're all still alive.
Oh, excellent.
Yeah, and I'm 78.
Right.
My mum had four boys in 5 years.
Right.
So,
and then she put her foot down, obviously.
Well, she didn't. She wanted to have more.
But, right.
So I think her body just gave out, actually, with all of that sort of,
effort
and tearing and pushing and pulling and everything.
Right. Now, I'm just going to ask you, look, whenever I hear about somebody having four children wanting more, you weren't Roman Catholics, were you?
No, we weren't. So, we were Anglican.
Anglicans, right.
Nothing these days, but in those days, no, as an Anglican. But just in those days, you had big families.
Yes, yes.
You probably came from one too, did you?
No, there's only three of us.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Well, I mean...
Well, that is a big family in 2025, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. It really is. Yeah. No, well, even before our generation, I think it was even bigger. You know, you'd have six or seven in the family.
Right.
But all my grandfather was one of eight.
Right.
So,
you had to have kids if there's no social security system. Somebody had to look after you in your old age.
Oh, and nothing much to do at night.
Yeah, and no contraception worth talking about. Yeah, I can understand. So it sounds a little bit idyllic. Did you go to school in Chinchilla?
I did. I went to primary school.
I assume it was a private school, being the son of a butcher.
Well, I went to the Chinchilla Primary School, and I made some really good friends there. They are still friends of mine. We still get together, quite often.
Right, and, that's extraordinary.
Well, I like doing it because it keeps me in touch. You know, I mean, if you live in the city for a long period of time, which I did, you tend to think, and the inner city at that, you tend to, think in a bubble. And it's really good to get back out there and see my old mates from school and realise, there are other parts of the world that you don't see on a regular basis, and you should be aware of it and feel a connection to it too. So I like doing that. But I went away to boarding school.
Now let's get back to primary. I want to ask two questions before we move on. You said your father was a returned serviceman from World War II. Was he involved in the fighting or more support service?
Yes, yeah. He was over in the Middle East for a while.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the fighting wasn't too bad over there. I think they fought the Vichy French, actually.
Right.
Like my dad never talked about these things much. But the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor and threatened Australia, and the Prime Minister of Australia at the time, John Curtin, demanded that the Australian troops over in the Middle East come home and defend Australia. Churchill, the British Prime Minister, didn't want them to, and so there was a big fight between Churchill and Curtin over this, and which Curtin finally won. But my dad was in the middle of all that. He was one of the troops who was put on a ship in the Middle East, and they went out into the Mediterranean Sea, not knowing where they were going.
Yeah.
He tells a story that they're on board one night, and somebody looked up and said, "Hey, it's the Southern Cross. We're going home. We're going home."
Right.
all the cheers broke out.
Yeah. Well, when you cross the equator, that's the beauty about the Southern Cross, isn't it? It's like the Eureka rebels in 1854 when they took on the Southern Cross. Because it reminded them when they were in their camps, they were looking up in the sky and they could see the Southern Cross, and they realised they were in a different part of the world, and it was a new world and a new beginning. So I can understand your father and his mates, being quite excited to see the Southern Cross because they knew they were going south.
they also knew that Australia was under attack they wanted to get home and lend a hand.
So it didn't actually cloud the way he lived his life after World War II?
No, well, he had malaria, and he had that for a number of years after he got home, but it gradually left his system.
Right.
And I think he probably, I wouldn't say he was badly affected. He saw a lot of fighting in New Guinea. He was in some of the worst fighting in 1944 and 45,
right.
When they were trying to push the Japanese back out of the Pacific.
Yes.
And so he was actually in one action where his lieutenant got the Victoria Cross.
Right.
In that campaign, so he did see a bit of pretty strenuous action. So I can't say I thought he suffered from PTSD or anything like that, because he was. He was a good father. I love my father, and I miss him to this day.
Right. And you said you went to primary school in Chinchilla. Were the Hutton boys the terrors of the school?
I wouldn't say that. Well, my mum was one of these women who never, she was a very gentle person, but she was such a strong character, and we loved her so dearly that all she needed to do was say, "Drew, I'm very disappointed with you," and you would just crumple.
Yes, yes.
So the discipline was pretty light, but it was effective.
She understood.
No, we were okay. My brother Max was a bit of a terror, but I don't think we were terrorised at school.
Right. Did you do much sport at primary school?
Oh yes, I did a lot of sport. I was a runner. I played tennis. In fact, I made the Queensland Primary School's tennis team. I captained team, and I played cricket. I played football. I played everything.
Everything.
And,
right.
I used to win, quite a bit in my age group. So that was my dad. He got me going in all of that.
You haven't kept the pennants and the trophies, have you?
No.
They're not in some drawer somewhere in Chinchilla?
Well, my mum kept them in a drawer, and the only reason to keep them in a drawer was when the Boy Scouts used to come around, used to have a bob a job.
All right.
They'd come around, you got a job for us? And mum would pull out all my trophies, and they'd clean them.
All right. Well, she was very utilitarian there. You said you went to boarding school. How old were you?
We didn't have a high school in Chinchilla at that stage. This was 1960 in my grade 8 year.
Right.
And so my dad never went to high school, so he was very keen that I go to school and that I go to a place where I had a chance to get really involved in sport. So he always liked Brisbane Grammar School, liked the look of it.
Right.
And so he said, "Well, my sons are going to go to Brisbane Grammar School, so they know high school in Chinchilla." So he sent me there.
That would have meant a lot of sausages.
It did. Yeah. Well, Dad sent three of us. Dad and Mum sent three of us to Hoyta boarding school.
Right. Because that's quite an expensive undertaking for somebody who's just running a butcher shop.
Yeah, well, we lived pretty frugally. Got free meat, of course.
Mm-hmm.
We weren't wealthy. But adequate, and my parents sacrificed in order to give us an education.
So, was your mother working?
Yeah, she went back working as a school teacher. She was a teacher when my dad first met her, and you had to resign from teaching once you're married in those days.
That's right,
They didn't have married women. But then they got them back again in the 60s because there was such a teacher shortage. And, so Mum went back to teaching when I went away to boarding school.
Right.
She stayed there about 10 years.
So what was it like that first day you boarded and you entered? I assume your parents took you down, your dad or Mum took you down to? Or did they put you on a train? Which one?
No, they took me down. And... the first day was terrible. I remember I got the older boys in the boarding house saw me, because I was pretty tall. I was about over 6 feet.
Right.
Even at that age.
And what's that, 14, 15?
I was
13, you're 6 foot. Yeah. God, I'd hate to meet you in a dark alley.
Well, a few boys met me in a dark alley and beat the crap out of me.
Right.
That was my introduction to boarding school.
Right.
I got a few of them back before the end of my time there too, I might add.
All right.
But it was a pretty brutal place, to tell you the truth. We had a brutal headmaster, and that sort of reign of terror transmitted itself down the line. You know,
right.
The kids who came off worse were the poor little young ones who, couldn't defend themselves all that well.
Right, and I assume corporal punishment was still part and parcel of the teaching experience.
Oh God, yeah. It was a daily occurrence, and the story I usually tell to illustrate the brutality of it was every now and then we'd get food poisoning in the boarding house because the food was terrible.
Mm.
And so one night we got these cold green sausages in congealed fat,
right.
And for the dinner, and nobody could eat it. Nobody was game to eat it. You know, we knew we'd be very sick if we did.
Right.
And so the headmaster decided that was a rebellion. We were mutinying, and he couldn't cane a lot of us. We used to have a meeting before we went to prep at night, and he'd come over. And anyway, he called this one kid out,
right.
Just to make an example of him. He gave him 10 cuts on the backside in front of the whole boarding house assembly,
right.
And cut his backside to pieces. Because our headmaster was 6'7", and a huge man. And when he wielded the cane, you really felt it.
And there were no consequences then, were there?
No consequences.
Whatsoever. It was expected.
Yeah.
How did you get yourself educated in such an environment?
Well, I mean, I was big. I was smart.
Mm-hmm.
I was good at sport. I could defend myself.
Right.
I survived. I ended up being school captain of the school.
What year was that?
1964.
Did you start noticing changes in 64 in your graduation year?
Oh, yes. Just starting. The first thing I was aware of was actually popular music. You know, this is the time of the Rolling Stones and the Beatles and Bob Dylan and so on.
Mm.
And I just loved all that. You know, I loved the cultural challenge that all of that represented.
Mm.
And, black music and all that sort of thing. And there was change in the air. I can remember I wrote a... we had a school magazine, and I wrote a couple of essays for it. One was on John F. Kennedy,
right.
Which got published. And I was actually praising of Kennedy, even though I thought there were a... because I was a bit of a smaller liberal,
right? Yep.
And I thought Kennedy was doing a pretty good job, and I wrote one also on Prime Minister Menzies, the Conservative Prime Minister of Australia at the time.
Yes. Mm.
And I got stuck into him, and it got censored by the headmaster.
Right.
Never saw the light of day, that is.
Right.
But anyway, I survived in that time, and flourished, actually, really, despite the brutality of the place.
Right.
And I tried to mitigate the brutality as much as I could.
Mm.
And tried to stop the bullying that was going on. But, the whole system was too entrenched.
It is entrenched, that's right. You know, it's just a drop in the ocean, individual initiatives. I mean, that's life, isn't it? You know, individuals kind of arc up, but unless they're backed, nothing changes.
Yeah, that's right.
That's the story of life. So what is a young lad who's captain of Brisbane Grammar, 1964, do when he graduates?
Oh, well, one thing I always enjoyed doing when I was in the boarding house was helping the younger kids with their homework.
Right.
Because I used to have to supervise kids doing their homework. And at night, we called it prep.
Yep.
And I used to enjoy doing that. I thought, you know, I was reasonably good at explaining stuff to kids, and I thought, you know, school captains of Brisbane Grammar School usually go on to become either business executives or teachers or lawyers.
Right.
And I thought, no, I think I'll become a... sorry, not teachers, lawyers or doctors or business people.
Right.
And I think I'll become a teacher. Right. So I did arts at University of Queensland. And
there was only one university in those days. That was the St. Lucia, University of Queensland, for the whole of Queensland. Yep.
That's right, there was. Mm. So I went there in 65, just as the Vietnam War was starting. And I mean, it was an exciting place, actually, in those days. I was exposed to, you know, we had forums in the student area. And people, you know, people like Brian Laver and Mitch Thompson and so on would get up and speak. And, you know, you'd sit around in the refect having political arguments with people. And, you know, you hardly ever went to class. But, you learned a lot in the refectory.
Yeah.
So certainly about politics.
Well that's the difference. I think people don't understand universe. I mean, I came after you a few years later. People don't understand that universities were actually like universities should be. And I believe that the introduction of continuous assessment is what destroyed that cultural milieu, which allowed students to take their time, learn about life, get involved in politics, reformist, radical, whatever it was, think about the issues of the day and take action. But when continuous assessment came, all that stopped.
Yes. It did. And it's interesting at the University of Queensland because they built out the area where all the student forums used to be. So students couldn't gather in large numbers anymore. So between continuous assessment and a bit of creative architecture, they really depoliticised student life on campus.
It means, look, I haven't been on campus at the University of Queensland, I think, since 1975. I'm coming back late October for a 50th year reunion of the medical graduates of 1975. You mean I can't sit in the quadrangle anymore and drink coffee and listen to interesting people?
Yeah, that's right.
It's all gone.
it really was very exciting. But in 67, I decided to leave uni. I wasn't doing
this call
all that well.
Will be recorded.
Whoa.
What was that?
I don't know what that was.
Look, it's just ASIO, Drew. You do have a reputation. Don't worry about it. They pay us to record people, okay? They're too stupid to listen to the podcast.
You're listening to a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We need your financial support to keep going. Go to www.3cr.org.au for more information and to donate online. Now stay tuned to hear the rest of your 3CR podcast.
The other thing I was doing at this stage was trying to make the Olympics.
Right, in what sport?
In athletics.
Right.
I was the state 800 metres champion.
Mm-hmm.
And I tried to get to the Mexico Olympics in 68, but I got injured a bit before the trials.
And
anyway, even if I hadn't been injured, I would have had trouble getting into the team because we had a bloke in Australia called Ralph Dubell.
That's right. I remember Ralph Dubell.
He went on to win the gold medal and set the world record. So, he was a bit hard to beat.
Yes.
But anyway, I was doing a lot of athletics at the time, and I wasn't doing all that brilliantly in university. I was passing, but I wasn't passing brilliantly. So I thought, I'll leave university and go to teachers' college, which I did in 67.
Right. So this is the height of the Vietnam War, and I assume conscription had been introduced. Obviously, you could defer conscription, but did your number come up?
No, it didn't.
For listeners who don't understand what we're talking about, could you explain what I meant by numbers came up?
The Menzies government introduced conscription into the army in 1964, and people didn't quite know what it was all about. And they found out once the Vietnam War got going in 65, because it meant that people, young men who were conscripted at the age of 20 went into the army and could be sent to Vietnam. So it was a really big thing. And I was in the second draft, I think.
Yeah.
But my number didn't come up. And it was very lucky for me that it didn't, because the only way you could get out of the draft was if you you had to join the militia, the
CMF,
and you had to be in that for 6 years. And I thought, bugger that, I'm not going to be in the CMF for 6 years. That's a lifetime. And the other option was to go on the run and go underground. And that wasn't, and in that, at that stage, there was no underground in Queensland.
Yes.
It was really difficult to go on the run. An underground network was set up soon after that, but not when I was in the draft.
And you've got to remember, this is the height of the Bjelke Petersen era also.
Well, it wasn't Bjelke Petersen at that stage, but it certainly it was a coalition government, a very conservative government in Queensland.
Mm.
And you couldn't... there was, laws against street marching, rallies, any of that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And so that in order to actually protest against the war, you had to, you actually had to go out in the street and get clobbered by the police, because it was actually illegal to even walk out in the street.
That's right.
In a march. So it was not only campaign against the Vietnam War, was a campaigning for civil liberties.
So did you get yourself involved in those type of activities in 67, 68?
Not really. I did to a certain extent. I got involved in the anti-Vietnam stuff. I went to a couple of the rallies there. But the big one was actually a civil liberties march that went from the University of Queensland to march into the city. And I was at the teachers' college at that stage, so I wasn't privy to all the discussion and debate that was going on about it. And I had a girlfriend at the University of Queensland at the time, and she was pretty conservative politically, I thought, because I thought I was a big rat, you know. And she was saying, "Oh, this will be really important, Drew. You should come to it." And I thought, "Oh, if she thinks it's important, then it's probably not much." So I didn't bother going. It turned out to be the biggest civil disobedience in 50 years in Queensland. There were hundreds of students got arrested when they sat down in Rover Street in the city centre.
Yeah.
And it was one of the big things that happened in that period of time. And I missed it.
Right.
I was really unhappy.
Well, you made up for it later on, Drew, knowing your past history. We'll get on to that in a minute. You made up for it.
That's what one of my friends always joked. Drew Hutton missed the 67 March, and he's been trying to make up for it ever since.
Exactly. Well, I think he could be right, you know, whoever he is. So when did you finish Teachers College?
67. It was just a one-year course.
Right. And what? You went straight to teaching?
Well, I went straight to teaching from there.
Mm.
I was kept in Brisbane for a couple of months until the Olympic trials were over.
Right.
In those days, I didn't use influence. I had no influence, but a couple of my lecturers did, and they used a bit of influence with the department to keep me in Brisbane.
Right.
But as soon as I didn't make the Olympic team, they transferred me out of Brisbane.
Right.
Ironically, it was to replace the girl I was engaged to,
right.
who was teaching out at a little school called a place called Injune.
Right.
And she was transferred, and I was transferred to replace her.
Right. So how long did you last in Injune?
Oh, till the end of the year.
Right.
Then I came back to Brisbane. I was brought back to Brisbane, and I taught there until 1976.
Right.
Still there.
Right. Now, when was your first taste of radical Queensland politics, and what led you there? Because, you know, you've got a background that doesn't kind of fit, does it?
No, it doesn't.
And that's the beauty. That's why we do Radical Australia. We want to show people that people come from all backgrounds. You know, people who are interested in justice and equality come from all backgrounds.
Right. Well, I didn't come from wealthy parents. My parents were never wealthy, but in fact, they probably just scraped by in some ways. But nevertheless, I was school captain at one of the major private schools in Queensland, and I sort of had that, status, I suppose. But I was, I blame my mother.
Most people blame their mother. I'll ask Daryl. Daryl, did you blame your mother for the fact that you found yourself at 3CR?
Oh, of course.
Of course.
Even though she's been dead for over 10 years. But
it was her fault, wasn't it?
It's still her fault.
Well, my mum was such a humanitarian, you know, and she taught me all these humanitarian values. And despite the fact that, you know, I came from a school where most people, you know, went straight into sort of conservative sorts of professions and conservative politics, I was very much attracted to, radical liberal politics. Yeah.
Well, did religion play a role in that, or?
No, not
at all.
No.
Right. No. So what, you threw away the crucifix at a younger age?
Well, I don't know that I ever had a crucifix.
All right. being an Anglican, I forgot, yeah.
Yeah, that's right. So where was I, Joe?
You're entering into radical ideas and politics, yeah.
Oh, Vietnam War.
Right.
As soon as I got back to Brisbane with teaching. I got back involved again. I spent 1968 teaching out at Injian at a time when, you know, the Paris students were staging a revolution. You know, the Tet Offensive occurred in Vietnam. The Russians invaded Czechoslovakia. You know, the radical students were, you know, raging all around the world. And I was teaching in India. It was very frustrating. So when I got back to Brisbane, I started getting involved, even though I was teaching full time, and I was still running actually at that stage. So it was difficult for me to do.
So how did you start getting involved? What did you get involved in?
The moratorium.
Moratorium. Well, in organisational capacity or as a?
No, I wasn't an organiser.
Right.
Because I was a teacher. You know.
Right. Oh yeah. That in those days. When did Bjelke Petersen ascend the throne?
68.
So that's during
And I was newly married, and
tell us about that.
Well, I married a girl that I sat next to at teachers' college.
Oh.
And
that's pretty ordinary, isn't it?
It was a bit, I'd say. She was a nice girl.
All right.
We were divorced a year later, but we had a marriage, had two sons, that kept me pretty busy. But at the same time, I was running at least for a couple of years until I got too badly injured, had to retire. But I put a lot of energy into teaching. I tried to be a good teacher, and so I didn't get involved in an organisational capacity in politics. I was a foot soldier.
Right. So
but
when... Keep going.
In 1972, I decided that... they gave me a class in senior modern history to teach. And I thought, well, I do know a bit about history, but I don't know as much as I'd like to. And so I went back to university. My wife and I both went back. We took a year off teaching and went back to university, and I finished my degree part time by this stage, so I had an arts degree. I wanted to do a postgraduate study, so I went and started doing postgraduate study, and did quite well. So, I enjoyed that. But at the same time, I was back on university, and there was this organisation there called the Self-Management Group that I ran into, and there was a Joe Toscano there who was part of it as well. So,
well, that's right. You've outed me now, you know. I wasn't a foundation member. I think I was their first, one of their first recruits.
Yeah. Well,
I mean, it was centered around the Red and Black Bookshop, which was the place you would, were told never to send your children to.
That's right. You were.
A den of iniquity.
Well, in fact, I knew the owner of the Red and Black Bookshop, Brian Laven. I knew him from school. I went to Brisbane Grammar School and played, and I was the captain of the tennis team there. And he was a couple of years ahead of me, but he was at Churchy, and I played against him when Brisbane Grammar played Churchy in tennis. And so I knew him, and I knew who he was, and I knew him well enough to say hello to on university campus. So. He was the first person I made contact with. I walked into the Red and Black Bookshop and talked to Brian about politics. And,
what attracted you to the Self-Management Group?
The democracy aspect. I was because I'd been to such an authoritarian school. I thought, no, I'm going to fight for democracy if I fight for anything in this world. And I thought the Self-Management Group, which was basically an anarchist group, was, said people have the right to control their own lives. And I've just been to a school where that was the direct opposite set of values that predominated. So that's what attracted me, the democracy aspect of it.
So, look, unfortunately, I deserted you in end of 1976 when I was banned from every public hospital in Queensland by the Bjelke-Petersen government for being a member of the Self-Management Group, but obviously you continued to teach in the public sector.
Well, it was interesting, you know. I actually went to teach at Teachers College.
Ah, right.
In 1976. I went back to university again in 1976, ran out of money, felt that, I might have to go back teaching. And just at that moment, I was rung up by the Teachers College to ask if I wanted to take a course there from my old sister teacher, actually, who'd just died.
Right.
So I went and replaced him for 6 months. Right. And then they said, oh, we'd like you to stay on. So that's how I got into tertiary education. And That was my entry into that world.
Which gave you a bit of protection?
It did, because it wasn't quite under the... It was controlled by the Queensland government, by the Education Department at the time, but it had a little bit of autonomy. So whenever I was arrested or had to face court on some civil disobedience charge, the Minister for Education would ring up the head of my school and the head of the college I taught at, and say, did he miss any classes? so he would send a message down to my head of department, did he miss any classes? And my head of department was a good guy, and he said, no, he was here all the time.
Although you were in jail, you were there all the time. So what type of protest led to your arrest?
Oh, well, that wasn't really until the 80s.
That was in the 80s. Okay.
Yeah, I didn't really get arrested in the 70s, although I did take part in a whole lot of the demonstrations that occurred at that time.
Right.
And I was involved in the Self-Management Group, and we were very active doing a whole lot of things.
Right. Were you involved in that time when they tried to fit some of the lads and lasses with drug charges?
I wasn't involved in that particular one.
Right.
But I did... Greg George was the main one.
That was a great victory. I mean, nobody could believe that they actually proved the Victoria Police were a bunch of corrupt cops before, their expose, and they actually won that case.
Yes, it was the first time, really, that there was a breakthrough on that.
Yeah.
I mean, years later, all of this came out, but we knew at the time they were a bunch of crooks.
Oh, definitely, I can assure you, we knew that. So, obviously, by the mid-70s, there were tensions within the self-management group regarding different strategies. So, what position did you take?
Well, I was in the in that group that thought, you know, we needed to be well organised, needed to have, you know, clear perspective on strategy, and I suppose ideologically a collectivist rather than individualist.
Right.
So we renamed ourselves the Libertarian Socialist Organisation.
That's right. Yep.
And whereas some went into Marxist organisation, so some were even more, you know, sort of attracted by strong organisation, centralised organisation than we were.
Mm.
Whereas others went into more an individualist cultural sort of anarchism, and you know the Libertarian Socialists and the Individualists actually got together again later, but in a more of a loose coalition than a coherent organisation. But, it was an interesting time. It's a pretty tense time too, really.
Oh, it was very tense because everybody was under surveillance. People had been banned from working. We had industrial groups and workers were being blacklisted on the docks and the wharves and the shipyards, and people like myself had been blacklisted from public hospitals, and it was an extraordinarily interesting time, considering how small the numbers were, the amount of tension we were able to create in the community.
Yes, shouldn't underestimate it, mind you.
The
self-management group could get meetings of 100 people.
That's right.
Could come along to them, and probably the influence spread, you know, at least 4 or 5 times as wide as that. It wasn't a tiny organisation, and look, to be fair to it, I mean, I broke from it a few years later, which I can talk about. But to be fair, it did teach you about politics. There were all sorts of efforts made to have good, far-reaching, robust discussions about all sorts of issues.
Mm.
We tried to write, carefully thought out, programmatic statements and statements about issues. And
like the case against terrorism, which I still think is quite as relevant today as when it was written almost 50 years ago, over 50 years ago.
Well, that was Greg George.
That's right.
He was very important in that. It was called "You Can't Blow Up a Social Relationship."
That's right.
And I'd like to see that resurrected today, because I think there's a growing aggressiveness, contempt for non-violence that's around in the movement these days. And we really need to have the sorts of discussions that went on in those days about how actually do you do political work that engenders good values.
Now, you said you kind of came to an end with your relationship with the Libertarian Socialists. What was the ideological reason?
Well, it was... I actually had some fairly strong disagreements with Brian Labor.
Mm.
For me, anarchism, was fairly... it was really good on the democratic issues, not so good on how you organise society as a whole.
Right.
And also issues of leadership. I thought anarchism was a bit blind on some of the issues of leadership. There is leadership. There always is. And you just need to formalise that a bit to make it obvious and to make it accountable. I also had differences on questions of law and the role of law. I thought there was a role, that law often is used as a weapon against, by elites against those at the bottom. But it also can be a defence against exploitation and oppression. And I didn't think the way we practiced anarchism was a you know, recognise that sufficiently.
Right.
And at the same time, I was reading about the German Greens, the West German Greens on the day, and a number of the well-known anarchists, like Danny Cohn-Bendit, for example, were interested in green politics and were early members of the West German Greens. And I started reading their stuff, and I thought, oh, this is interesting. You know, the values are the same as mine. It's just that the strategy is different.
Right.
They're a political party.
Yep.
And so I thought long and hard about it. But I still stayed in the anarchist. But I was worried that there was a sort of a. It's not as bad as some groups on the left, but we were in a bubble mentality.
Yes.
All we talked to was ourselves.
Exactly.
And we didn't. We needed to, you know, talk to ordinary people and test our ideas out in that context a lot more than we were,
mm-hmm.
And to actually treat people who didn't agree with us with a bit more respect than we were.
Right.
And so I thought, well, you know, the anarchists, you know, libertarian socialists needed to, you know. Connect up with other groups, and I pushed for that, and we did. We set up an organisation called a coalition, called the People for Direct Democracy. We worked with Christian groups and you know, other sorts of anarchist groups and human rights groups and so on, and we're open, far more open to working with non-anarchist organisation. And, I mean, that's basically where I worked with Brian.
Yeah, that's fine. So where did that lead you, that break?
To the Greens.
To the Greens. Was the Greens established then, or?
Oh, no.
So tell us about your role in the establishment of the Australian Greens Party.
Well, I it was actually Brian Laver's idea first. His idea was to set up a Greens and use that as a fund for anarchism.
Right.
And my argument was, well, you know, no, you don't.
Well, against everything we were against. I mean, front organisations were part and parcel of Marxist ideology.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. If you're going to set up a political party, you're at least honest about what.
Be honest about it. Yeah.
Yeah. So. I differed with Brian on that. In order to start discussions about it, I started some discussions. The first ones that we had were in my living room. I called together a whole lot of people I knew from New Left days.
What year was this? What year was this?
That was 84.
Right.
And, we talked it around and... it was interesting. A whole lot of the old New Left people didn't want to join. A couple did, but most of them didn't.
Right.
And
any reasons given?
I think they balked at the idea of a political party. That was the main thing.
Yep.
I think they thought getting into parliamentary politics is, you can do it. I don't particularly want it.
Right. Yep.
But it were the peace movement people were actually the ones who were interested in the Greens.
What peace movement people in 1984?
Oh, well, it was the against the nuclear. It was for nuclear disarmament.
That's right. That was the time of the nuclear disarmament party, wasn't it?
Well, they hadn't set up at this
stage. They hadn't set up
before then.
Right.
It was a huge movement.
Right, it was huge. They got close to getting a senator in.
Well, they did get...
They got a senator. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. And this is where Peter Garrett first got involved in politics. So, it was a really important issue. And some of those people went and formed a party called the Nuclear Disarmament Party, but others in Queensland came and joined the Greens.
You set up. Was it a branch of the Greens? Were you in contact?
No, it was called the Brisbane Green Party.
The Brisbane Green Party.
Yeah,
right.
Didn't pretend to be any bigger than that.
Yeah, right.
At the same time, there was a Sydney Green, was set up too.
Right.
So there were two little local Green parties in Australia at the time.
Right.
And, of course, there had been a Tasmanian Green Party had been set up back in the 70s. It wasn't called the Green Party. It was called the United Tasmania Group. But it was a Green Party, effectively, and it was really the first Green Party in the world.
Right.
So, there were Green Parties being set up, and I was part of that, and I set up this Brisbane Green Party. We contested the 85 Brisbane City Council election. I was the mayoral candidate. I got 4%.
Right. Well, better than I did. When I stood for the Melbourne City Council, I got 1.5%, so congratulations.
Thank you very much. and we stood in four seats, and each of those candidates got about 10%.
Oh,
so that wasn't too bad. You know.
No, for something that started in a living room.
Yeah, that's right. We're with about 10 people.
Right. So do you have any constitutional arrangements or anything?
No,
just a Green Party, right? So when did you start spreading your wings?
Well, in that 85 council elections, really.
Mm-hmm.
Then in Bob Brown at that stage was an independent in the a Green independent in the Tasmanian Parliament, and he just finished with the Franklin Dam campaign, and I didn't know him at that stage, and I knew about him, of course, and he'd heard about me, and he got in touch, I suppose, soon after the council elections, actually.
Right.
And he said, you want to come to this meeting I'm organising? And the meeting was to bring together all the different disparate green-type organisations around the country. You know, not necessarily green politics, but...
Right.
Green collectives, there were any number of them, conservation organisations. We organised a conference called the Getting Together Conference in Sydney in 1986, and it was pretty big. There were about 600 people came to it,
right.
Activists from all around the country, and my theme in that conference, it wasn't the only theme, but my theme was a Green Party.
Right.
Australia. Mm. And all that we could agree on was that we didn't agree.
Right.
Some people were saying, we don't need a Green Party, we've got the Democrats.
Right.
And others were saying, no, you don't want a Green Party, it'll just become a bureaucratic monster.
Right.
And others were saying, no, we don't need the Green Party, we've got the Labor Party.
Right.
So it was, we couldn't get agreement. And not a lot came out of that, although some good connections. Bob and I became good friends. I got to know a lot of, activists around the country.
Yep.
And, I helped to set up this organisation called the Rainbow Alliance.
Right.
Joe Camilleri from Melbourne was a key player in all of that.
Right.
And it wasn't a political party, though. It was just a movement organisation. And at the same time, I became very active on environmental issues and became quite well known in Queensland.
Right.
On issues, especially on pollution-type issues, but just about anything.
Right.
Yeah, and I worked very, very hard at that period of time.
Yeah. Now, Drew, you won't believe this. The hour is up.
Good heavens.
We're going to continue next week. We've got a minute or two, but we're going to continue next week. And obviously, next week will all be about the Green Party and how it's developed and how you find yourself in the situation you find yourself in at the end of 2025. So, that, like I told you when I first rang you, when Leon, he suggested I give you a call, and he finds interesting guests for us. And I said, oh, God, bloody Drew, he's long-winded. It'll be 2 hours before we get to the nitty-gritty. So, look, I'm really pleased we can podcast this because I think it's important that, history is recorded by those who make history. And I think it's essential that we get everybody's viewpoints regarding issues that arise in any organisation, which is full of human beings with who pull in different directions for different reasons. Thank you, Drew. We will resume at 4 o'clock next Wednesday, which I think is the 30th of July. Thank you very much, Daryl.
You're welcome, Joe.
And I'll give you a call next Tuesday just to confirm, but it'll be next Wednesday, and we'll finish your story. Thank you very much, Drew.
Okay, Joe. Thanks a lot. Nice to talk to you.
Good. Bye-bye.
Bye.
You have been listening to Radical Australia with presenter Joe Toscano and special guest Drew Hutton here on 3CR Community Radio, 855 AM on your dial, online at 3cr.org.au, and this program is being podcasted.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.